Last week, Joe Johnston was announced as the director for The Silver Chair, and Douglas Gresham told Narniweb that, quote, things are happening at last. This episode was recorded before that announcement, but the topic of what kinds of changes we can expect to the story is still very timely. And welcome back to Talking Beasts, everyone, NarniWeb.com podcast. I am Glumpuddle, and I am here with...
Patter Twigs Pal, also known as Twigs. I am the moderator of cast and character discussion and the reading groups.
The reading group, we'll talk about that in a moment. But apologies to our listeners, we didn't have the budget for Patter Twig himself, but we were able to secure his pal at the last minute. But this is your second time on the podcast, right?
Yes, this is my second time on the podcast.
Yeah, first time on Talking Beasts, though.
Yes.
So a second chance. Okay. We've got hopefully a good show today. I could really use this personally. It was long day at the office, and I just think it's right now some Narnia nerdy Narni Weberness would be really therapeutic right now. How was your day?
It was also a long day. It was very much a Monday.
Oh, it is Monday, isn't it?
That explains
a lot of things. Okay, let's talk about The Silver Chair. Okay, I think this will make my day start getting better immediately. So you mentioned you're going to be leading the reading group, and we're going to be starting The Silver Chair shortly. Why don't you tell us how that's going to work?
Yes. So I'll post a chapter, maybe two, each week, and there'll be questions that people can respond to. They don't have to respond to all of the questions or even any of the questions. If they have other thoughts they want to write, that's fine. They don't have to go at the same pace. They can post whenever they want to. However, we will be mentioning some of their answers on the podcast. So the sooner you reply, the more likely you are to get your answer on the podcast.
That's the idea. And if you want to get to the Silver Chair reading group, you just go to the NarniWeb.com. Go to NarniWeb.com, click on forum, and then scroll down. You'll see a link for the Silver Chair reading group, and then there'll be one thread per chapter. And I just wanted to reemphasize what Twig said, that you don't have to answer all the questions.
No. We're
probably about 10 questions or so per chapter. If you want to answer only one or two, or just come up with your own, that's fine.
Yes, and if you want an idea of how it works, the Voyage of the Dawn Treader reading group is archived in the archived forums, and you can see that people posted answers to some of the questions, some of them did all the questions, some people didn't start the reading group until about a year after it had started. As long as the threads are open, they are open for posting. Okay.
All right. So really looking forward to that. Figured what better time to really break down The Silver Chair chapter by chapter than when they're gearing up for a movie adaptation, possibly. So this episode, we're going to start off by responding to some of your comments from the previous episode. Then we'll get into our main discussion talking about The Silver Chair. Real kind of specific changes we anticipate or are scared to death of, perhaps. And then we're going to try to stump Twigs here and with a trivia question. And no pressure, but I'm currently leading by 1 point. You have the opportunity to take the lead if you can answer without blowing Susan's horn. So I know you're shaking in your, you're probably not wearing boots. What are you wearing right now?
Socks.
I know you're shaking in your socks. I know it. Once again, we got a really good response to the last episode, which was about just adaptation philosophy in general. Mel put together just a few comments that thought might be fun to respond to. I saw two that I thought were connected. Lord Argos said, as for future Narnia film adaptations, I would really like to see less emphasis on special effects, CGI monsters, and epic battle scenes, and more emphasis on getting the atmosphere, feelings, and messages. And on a related comment, the Rose Tree Dryad said, I really enjoyed the discussion about the importance of atmosphere in stories. It's those scenes that allow the atmosphere to build, that give life to the story, and give the audience a chance to feel something. Instead of sweeping them along with action sequence after action sequence, that is what Narnia all about to me. I imagine that's going to ring for you, Twigs.
Oh, yes. I really, really hope they do not try to squeeze in a battle in The Silver Chair. And that comment about the atmosphere, it made a lot of sense. And especially with Silver Chair, where the atmosphere is so important, you could just get the feeling of, I don't know, for me, it's a feeling of just kind of a gray dimness that they have.
It was a dull autumn day.
Yes. And other than a few brighter sparks, a lot of it is a kind of has that dull autumn day feeling, or the gloomy weather. The, you know, are they going to get through their mission? Are they going to follow the signs? Is it going to turn out okay? And of course, there isn't any sun in Underworld.
Yeah.
So I know I get to feel gloomy if the sun's not out for a long amount of time. I can't imagine being underground for all those days.
Whereas I grew up in Florida, so I actually like it when the sun's not out. So what I think they need to do to emphasize the darkness in Silver Chair is have Underland be like a bright, sunny day. Not really, actually. Hopefully, we could post that as an April Fool's joke, but then we know where that can lead.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Okay. I got another comment from Tame Lion, who said, I feel like with the Silver Chair, all we can do is wait. Can we also talk more about the horse and his boy in the next podcast? Maybe some general thoughts on the main characters. We can certainly do that. Twigs, any thoughts on the horse and his boy's characters? Especially since you have Erebus with you at your house right now.
Yes. My cat's name is Erebus. And she's a little
bit... So what inspired naming your cat Erebus, actually? I don't know that.
Personality-wise, I mean, Erebus in the books has some difficulty relating to her peers, Shasta, for one. And my cat, when she runs into other cats, goes into attack mode, so she doesn't understand how to relate to her peers either.
Interesting. I want you. I'm interested in what you said. That's really funny. I'm really interested in what the Erebus having difficulty relating to her peers. I've never thought about that before. Could you unpack that for me a bit?
Well, I guess the problem is she doesn't see Shasta as her peer. She sees him as inferior, somebody that she should be able to be above, tell what to do. I mean, even her friend, she's quite often judging. You know, she doesn't like all the fuss over the clothes, all the fuss over marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she gets along pretty well with Hwin and Bree.
Well, even with Hwin, she treats Hwin like her property.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
A little nicer to Hwin than Shasta, maybe, but still, it's completely, it's one of the things I enjoy about the horse and his boy is I think it's my favorite character dynamics in the series, and I think it's probably my favorite character dialogue in the whole series. Because with, you know, you have Erebus and Hwin, which is the more traditional relationship where Erebus is master and Hwin is property. And it seems like, you know, that's what the title refers to with Shasta and Bree. It seems like the other way around. It seems like, you know, Bree he's seen things and he knows things and Shasta knows nothing. So it kind of seems like Bree is the owner. But at the end, it's Shasta who finds out that he's a prince, and it's Hwin who is not afraid when confronted by Aslan. And of course, we know what happens to Erebus. She gets you know, terribly injured. So it's Shasta and Hwin who end up really, really coming out the other side better. Whereas the other two are humbled.
Yes.
But if anyone, thanks for the idea, Tame Lion. So obviously, like we just talked about at the beginning, we're planning on talking a lot about Silver Chair for obvious reasons in upcoming episodes. But if you guys would rather hear about something else, we can do other stuff too. So please, ideas for topics, post them below or email us at podcast@narniweb.com. So Twigs, like I mentioned, you recently reread The Silver Chair for the 5+ time, however many times it's been. We've also been talking about how we notice new things every time. So what thoughts do you have after reading The Silver Chair for however many times it's been?
I wish I'd kept count, because then when people ask me, I'd know the answer.
You know, it's hard for me because I've read it all the way through so many times, and then I've read sections of it. Like, I have no idea. It'd be impossible to piece it together.
Yeah. I'd say for noticing things the first time, Lewis uses a lot of titles rather than names. For, you know, he'll say the owl instead of Glimfeather. For quite a while, Puddleglum is the Marshwiggle. And also looking at the use of do the characters, does Eustace himself call himself, introduce himself as Scrub or Eustace? Because I think he did, I'm pretty sure he did both. So the use of Eustace versus Scrub, Jill versus Pole, a lot of the characters are for a while, Rillian's referred to as the Prince.
Interesting. I wonder if, and again, we have to see when they're used. I can say that I know that Eustace is generally referred to as Scrub in this book.
Yes, but he does introduce himself to Trumpkin as Eustace.
Interesting. But the narrator, for example, like usually if Lewis is referencing Scrub he did this, he says Scrub. Whereas in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, it's almost invariably just calls him Eustace. I always assume that was because I think of Jill as the main character, and she knows Eustace as Scrub. And it could also imply some character development. Scrub is a much less formal name, and that maybe Eustace, who's been humbled in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, of course, he does introduce himself as Eustace, though, doesn't he? So I don't know.
Yeah.
But it reinforces the idea of Jill being the main character because she knows him as Scrub.
Yeah, and like I said, I haven't had time to completely go through and look at it, but I just opened my book randomly, and this is in the Sailing of the King chapter. So it says, "Now said Scrub," but he didn't get any further because at that moment, a large white object. And then it goes through to talk about Glimfeather coming. But then the owl is saying, "Twoo, twoo, who are you two? My name's Scrub, and this is Pole," said Eustace. So
said Eustace. Interesting.
The first time one time he said it was said Scrub, and the next time it was said Eustace.
I wonder why that is. I wonder if there's any rhyme or reason to it. Anyway, that's something that if you're participating in the Silver Chair reading group, and you're actually really reading along with us, that's a good thing to look out for. If you can find, does Lewis just do the whatever comes to mind, or is there actually a method to this? Does this tell us something about the story or characters? One thing I noticed looking through it is that there's this running theme of Jill feeling inferior. A lot of it comes from the fact that she is sort of insecure about the fact that she's the only one that's never been to Narnia before. She's insecure even about the fact that Scrub got to sleep on air probably before she did. And when Scrub says, it's called a marshwiggle, the narrator adds, as if he were rather proud of the word. Rather proud of knowing the word. And you wonder, is that the narrator saying that, or is that Jill's perspective, who's feeling like, the Scrub knows more than I do? And then I think she's also a little jealous that Scrub gets to use, Puddleglum's second best bow, and she only gets to have a knife. There's a lot of examples of her feeling, and that's a lot of their dynamic, I think, is she wants to fit in with the others, but they have so much more experience of Narnia than she does, of course.
Yeah, I haven't really looked into that to decide how I think of that, but I do know that even after Eustace was changed into a dragon, he does have the tendency to be a little bit on the more proud side, pleased when he knows something.
Yeah, that's true. That's just the way Eustace is. But I kind of feel like it feeds into an insecurity Jill has as well. But anyway, that's something, if you're going to read The Silver Chair with us, look out for that keep one eye open for that and let us know if that's something you spot as well. So we are anticipating a movie of this book very shortly. And since this is the fourth movie, there's a few things that we can, as Narnia Webbers, we can already anticipate this will probably be an issue. At least this is something we'll be worried about. And there's a few things I just wrote down. One of them is adding action sequences. Are there any places in The Silver Chair, since it's fresh in your mind, where you can say, if they have a big enough budget, they'll want to expand this into a giant action scene?
Well, the only place that it could make even the slightest, teeniest, tiniest bit of sense would be in Underworld before they realize that they're on the same side as the gnomes. I could see them adding a little bit of a skirmish, kind of like Caspian and Peter in Prince Caspian before they realize they're on the same side, they're crossing swords. I really, really hope they do not do that.
Yeah, I think that would... Especially if I think that would once again, kind of like with what they did with Dark Island in the Dawn Treader movie. I think the book is so much scarier and so much creepier when it's quiet and they're just hearing things and you can't see anything. And I think they should, darkness is pretty cheap. I think they should embrace their lower budget, assuming they have one, and just have Underland feel kind of small and claustrophobic and not be this epic giant battle with the gnomes or whatever. Is that what you're picturing? Like an actual, like Puddleglum and the others possibly having to fight with the gnomes underground?
Yeah, fighting with, when they're right after the witch has been destroyed and they're trying to escape, the gnomes were preparing for a battle because they didn't realize that the queen was dead. So I'm worried that will actually come to a little bit of a battle before they realize that the queen is dead and they're on the same side as Rillian and the children in Puddleglum.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. I had thought about, I imagine the gnomes actually breaking out and attacking Cara Paravel and having some kind of battle there. And I could see them cutting back and forth between that and fighting the snake. And then the snake dies and all of a sudden the gnomes, just as they're about to blow up Cara Paravel or whatever, all of a sudden they go, wait a minute, what am I doing? And they all fall down Phantom Menace style. I could see them doing that. And once again, I'd just rather them keep things simpler and keep things more personal and intimate.
Oh,
but I can understand the temptation if you have this, oh, look at this giant army that we never get to see them do anything. I can understand the temptation. But I you're making a face.
Yes, I am making a face because that would be awful. I don't understand the temptation for battle scenes.
Well, I'll tell you the temptation in terms of we've been at this point in the story, we've been looking at this our army gathering and building now for a while, and then to never kind of get a payoff for that. I can understand in the flow of a film at least why that would be tempting, but I think that's more. The solution to that is not what we have to deliver. We have to have a big battle. The solution is, well, let's be careful not to emphasize the army too much earlier in the story. We don't want the audience to have false expectations. We want them to expect, oh, we're going to get a battle soon, and then feel let down when they don't get one. But just try not to promise one, basically. I think that's the other way to go. The Silver Chair, the end is already so crowded when you think about it. Actually destroying the Silver Chair. Then the queen comes along and tries to convince them that Narnia isn't real, a fight with the queen, all the talk about Bizum, and then meeting the bittersweet being reunited with Caspian before he dies, the epilogue. The third act is really long. There's a lot of stuff that happens.
It is.
As it is, they won't be able to fit everything in the movie.
Right. And I guess, I know in the book that they talk about how there's an army of Earthmen that come to take Eustace and Jill and Puddleglum prisoner, and then that there's going to be an army of Earthmen behind Rillian. But I guess I've always pictured it that in the city itself, it's like mostly just gnomes going around working, moving bundles, doing stuff like that, not in like armor or ready to fight.
Yeah, I would. I'm pretty sure we would rather not see them go too crazy with the battle at the end. I would just rather have the emphasis be on something else. I think there's already so much going on at the end there, and
yes,
I'd rather not have that in there. That's always a concern with these movies is, oh, we have to make these big and awesome or no one will go see them. No one wants just to see a good story anymore, which is, I think, clearly not true. Or there's a few more really specific scenes you wanted to talk about with the Silver Chair that could be a challenge. But first, here's our C.S. Lewis Minute.
I'm William O'Flaherty. This is a C.S. Lewis Minute. Most of C.S. Lewis's shorter writings have an equally short title. Do you know the one that is definitely an exception to this rule? Over his career, Lewis wrote a wide range of essays or gave talks that became available in print. A large number of them had only two or three words for the title. But then there's the essay first published in the New York Times Book Review called Sometimes Fairy Stories May Say Best, What's to Be Said. This title gives away one of the main points of the essay, but even though it is a short article by Lewis, provides a good deal more information. This includes the background for The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. where he notes he did not try to think up a way to teach Christianity to kids when he began it. This essay is best found in the book On Stories.
William O'Flaherty is the author of C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell and the creator of EssentialCSLewis.com. So, Twiggs, you started a thread, I guess it was a few weeks ago or whenever it was, maybe longer than that, about you were concerned about the Lady of the Green Kirtle and Rillian and basically how much the audience should know about them. Why don't you kind of talk about, kind of summarize your concerns?
I can't remember what I first thought when I read the story. Unfortunately, it was too many years ago. How much should the audience know? Should the audience know, for example, when they meet the Lady of the Green Kirtle on the road after they cross the bridge? Should they know that's the Lady of the Green Kirtle? Or should the filmmakers try to hide that fact so they're kind of wondering? Or should we go for the dramatic irony of it where the audience knows and they're screaming in their heads at Jill and Eustace, a little bit of Puddleglum, are you out of your minds for trusting this woman? She's probably up to no good. She's this, you know, very likely the same woman. Now, there's no reason to believe that any of those three ever saw the Lady of the Green Kirtle, but it is kind of interesting. As a reader, it's highly likely that you're going to suspect that. Now, if you were in the story, probably not. But I'm just wondering if the filmmakers need to address that somehow, if they want to make it obvious to the audience, or if they want to, you know, kind of make it so you're not really sure who that is, if that's important.
Basically, when she's revealed to be the bad guy, should that be a surprise, or should it be something we've been waiting for?
Right.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I would call this an adaptation issue is because in the book, I think most people who read the book of any age, they probably figure out, oh, that lady's bad and she's giving them bad advice. And part of that is I think Lewis as a narrator makes it pretty clear. You know, he says things like, oh, that they weren't thinking about the signs anymore. All they could think about was hot baths. And I think it's so I think in the book you do have an impending sense of doom. You know the characters are making a bad choice. And I think it's okay. I don't think you're a little annoyed or frustrated with them, but the fact that the narrator of the book clearly is acknowledging, yeah, this is bad. Like the narrator of the book is agreeing with you. I think that makes it tolerable. I wonder if in a movie where we don't get that narrator perspective, would it just be annoying? Would it be, just stop. You characters are idiots for not seeing this or for doing this.
Yeah, I don't know. But the narrator does leave it slightly open because he says something like, whatever she intended, this is was the result. So
right, but I think the fact that he's calling into question whatever she intended,
yes,
I think
there is an
impending sense of doom for the rest of that part of the book. We know they're making a bad decision, and we're just waiting for something bad to happen.
Yeah, and I think that can work because I've never really actually seen any horror movies, but I've seen them, you know, parodied on shows and stuff where it's like the audience knows that the person is making a bad choice when they, I don't know, go into the haunted house or whatever, but the character still does it. So that can work.
So it could work, yeah, because I think that's the book, essentially. Yeah,
I think
we know, and that's, you know, Alfred Hitchcock talked about, had a famous example where he said, let's say you have a scene where two people are talking about baseball. They talk about baseball, they're in a restaurant. They talk about baseball for 10 minutes, and then a bomb goes off. Well, that's really shocking. But now let's do a different version of that scene. In this version, the camera pans under the table, and we see the bomb. So now it's a really suspenseful scene when they're talking about baseball because we're thinking, there's a bomb. So basically his point was suspense in film comes from knowing more than the characters do. We know there's a bomb under the table and they don't. And that's why there's so much suspense about it.
Yes.
So you could take that approach to it. We know the Lady of the Green Kirtle is bad. We know that it's a bad idea, but the characters don't. That could be suspenseful, but I would want to do it in a way that we're not tired of, because the characters are still pleasing to read and enjoyable to read in the book, and I would hate for the audience to just they're idiots and just get frustrated about
it.
Yes, you know?
And no, that's probably not so much the problem with the Lady of the Green Kirtle, because they have no reason to necessarily. I mean, none of them have ever seen her, and
yeah,
so.
It's reasonable for the characters, yeah.
For the characters, not Now, what might be a little harder is, should the audience recognize Rillian? Because that's going to be harder to explain. Because presumably, Puddleglum would have seen Rillian at some point in his life, at least from a distance.
Yeah, and of course, BBC gave him a mask, the BBC version, which you like the BBC versions, right? How'd you feel about how they handled that?
I think that was fine. It's kind of odd when he's taking it off, but...
He rips it off. Like it looks like it's plastic, which it probably was.
But, you know, and
that's more a question of it. To me, it's not a question of, oh, we'll just put a mask and hide his face. Still, come on. We're getting to the end of the book. We just saw Under Me. We know Rillian's got to be down here somewhere. Why are they introducing this random character, this prince, and we're getting all this backstory information about him? Duh, obviously it's Prince Rillian. The audience just puts that together. I think most readers put that together. But I think it works because the main drama of the end of that scene is not so much, oh my gosh, Rillian, shocking moment. It's more, are the characters going to follow the signs? I think we know what the right thing to do is. We know that's Rillian. Set him free. Do what you got to do. But the characters, yes. Are they going to trust Aslan's signs, basically, you know?
Yeah, are they going to choose to follow the signs?
So that's just an interesting kind of film challenge there. I'll be curious to see what they do with it. Another scene that I want to talk about, it's my favorite scene in the entire series, and I think there's a real risk of them just rushing right on through it, is when Jill meets Aslan. There's two parts to that scene. I mean, first off, it is a brilliantly written scene because almost everything that comes out of Aslan's mouth is fascinating. I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms. It's just so many lines there. What makes him a much more interesting character? But there's two parts to that scene. It's a plot and exposition scene. It's here's the four signs. You know, explaining the lost print. He's outlining the entire plot of the book for us. That's number one. But number two, it's a character scene. He's telling Jill, okay, you have a choice between taking a drink of water and trusting that I'm not going to eat you, even though I refuse to make that guarantee, or dying of thirst. And the fact that Jill has to take that step is a very important character moment for her. The fact that Aslan forces her to admit you were showing off, you know? And the fact that Jill initially is so impressed by Aslan is very much attending to the signs. And then and later she finds him difficult to remember. Like, these are all things that tell us things about Jill. And I really don't want them to rush through it. I can see them treating it the same way they treated the logic scene in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe with the three possibilities, where they would just outline it and then move on. Just give us the bullet points and move on. So we get the information, but none of the emotional impact. I'm really concerned they're just going to say, here's the four signs, here's the lost prince, go. Because that's all you need from that scene for the story, just to make the story work. But if you skip all the character stuff, the movie doesn't work. I don't think we're emotionally invested in Jill. I don't think if we haven't sold Aslan being such an intimidating presence, I don't think we'll buy... Well, why should Jill trust in the signs, you know? I think it's because Aslan makes such a powerful impression on her. Anyway, you've heard all this before. But that's something that I'm anticipating and really concerned about that.
It is important. It's maybe a slower scene, but slow doesn't necessarily mean bad. If it's full of interesting lines and good information, then it's a good scene. And it's probably a lot... less confusing than some of the action scenes.
Yeah.
Just in general, like where there's so many people swinging swords around that you have no idea what's happening.
Yep. No, absolutely. This is a scene where they have to let it breathe. They can't just, okay, let's keep it moving. Let's, you know, get what we need from the scene and move on. No, we need to let this scene breathe and feel. I need to let Aslan breathe, maybe literally. And, feel that presence and feel what Jill is going through and the choice she's making. If this scene doesn't work, then probably the movie doesn't work. If you don't buy into this is what Jill has to learn right now with trusting the signs and trusting in Aslan. If you don't, and also if the signs aren't intriguing, because for me in the book, once I hear the, I remember the first time I read it, once I heard those four signs, I knew I was finishing the book. That was it. That was that. Because what are those signs going to look like? What's the writing going to be that they're going to find? What is the context that's going to be? Like, why would someone ask them to do something in Aslan's name? Oh my gosh, now I have to finish the book. If they don't get both of those elements right, then the movie doesn't work. Why bother even watching the rest of the movie? And I just think it's a scene where, again, we talked about atmosphere last week, and the atmosphere of that scene is really, really important. I don't want them to rush through that. Another atmosphere scene, you could argue, in the book is Bizum. At the talk, they've just freed Rillian, and now they got to get out of there. But Lewis takes the time for a few pages to talk about Bizum, the bottom of the world where you have liquid diamond and liquid gold and things like that. Which it doesn't have to be in there in terms of the story. You could easily get rid of it. And I'm not saying they should definitely include it. Like I said, the third act of Silverchair is crowded. But I will just straight up ask you, since you tend to be much more of a purist than me, do you think they have to have Bizum in there? I mean, even BBC didn't really include it.
Not much. They did have the gnomes going back in.
But they didn't explain what they were doing, so you just thought they were killing themselves. Sorry, I know you don't like when I pick on BBC.
No, that's fine. I'm just trying to remember the scene from the BBC.
Yeah, but is that something you think they have to have in the movie?
No, they wouldn't have to have it. I think it's interesting. I think it adds to the story. One thing I've noticed about the Silver Chair is that Lewis spends a lot of time talking about the different cultures in Narnia.
Uh-huh.
Because we talk, you know, we have the owl's perspective on the world. We have...
Right.
The giant's perspective, which is we don't really want. and then we've got, you know, we have Jill, who absolutely hates being underground. And then we have the gnomes who are talking about how great it is. So I think in this book in particular, we really get a feel for the different cultures and how different things are not necessarily wrong.
And for the gnomes, it's like they're inside the world and the other characters live on top of the world. That's their perspective.
Yes. So we get a lot of different perspectives, which I think is good.
Really good. I think it makes the world feel real because Lewis doesn't give us a lot of detail, but what he gives us makes you feel like, well, little he gives us makes you feel like that these are real people.
Yes, and they've got different perspectives, different roles, and for the most part, that's okay. I think we would all agree that the giants are not set up as one of the cultures that Lewis is saying is an okay version.
Right.
With the eating of the children.
But it's still cool to get the different perspectives. It makes them feel real. It makes the world feel bigger. Yeah, so again, I don't know if they should have Bizum in there, but what you're saying, I like that makes the world feel so rich and so real, and it's not just, oh, it's a story. No, it's a world we visit. I think that they've gotten too preoccupied in the other movies of just telling the story, just getting through the plot, and not enough of, let's just feel like we've gone and visited another world for a couple hours. We've lost some of that in the first three movies. So I'm not saying for sure they should have Bizum in there, but I hope they don't just railroad through the story and forget to feel the world we're in. But enough of that. Let's stump a Narnia Weber. That being you this time, Twigs, you're in the hot seat.
Lucky me.
an opportunity to take the lead here, potentially. But you know the rules. Today's question was submitted by Anne Finwin. Thank you for the question, Anne Finwin. Twigs, are you ready for your question?
I am ready.
Twigs, can you, unlike King Caspian, name all 7 missing lords that were discovered by the Dawn Treader crew?
Seriously?
And then you can read them in whatever order you want.
All right. I'm going to try it without the book. I'm probably going to regret that, but I'm going to try.
All right, let's go for it. I'll write them down as you list them.
All right. Burn.
Burn, of course, at the Lone Islands.
Restimar. Roop. Arsgaz. Mavramorn. Octasian.
Mm-hmm.
and I...
You're doing good so far. You've got one, two, three, four, five, six. You're just missing one.
Six, one. And unlike Caspian, I can always remember Roop.
Yeah, because we remember that Caspian couldn't remember it.
Yep.
I'll give you a little hint. The reason it's hard to remember is because he's just one of the three that was found at Romandu's Island.
Yeah, I had a feeling that. Let's see. There was the one that wanted... And they're not identified very much.
Yeah, exactly. One left. One
I
left.
Know.
I know there's people listening now screaming the answer.
Probably.
Well, if you want, I would still let you blow Queen Susan's horn and look it up in the book.
All right, I will look up the last one.
So I see you have your copy of Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, and your time starts now. I see Twigs leafing through, trying to find that seventh lord in the book.
Okay. Oh, it was an R. Revillian.
That is correct. Revillian was the missing lord, so you've got all seven now. But something about the letter R with lords, I guess, is hard for people to remember.
I guess.
In the order they were actually discovered, by the way, was Burn at the Lone Islands. Octesian possibly was the dragon or was killed by the dragon on Dragon Island. Restimar is in Deathwater. Roop at Dark Island. And then finally, Revillian, Argos, and Mavrimorn are all at Aslan's table asleep. But you had to blow Queen Susan's horn, so that gives you 1 point, which means you and I are tied.
Sounds good.
Yep. Thank you very much, Anne Finwin, for submitting the question. Anyone else, if you think you can stump a Narniweber, please submit ideas for trivia questions to podcast@narniweb.com. Please include stump in the subject, but do not include the answer. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. We're going to be back on Monday, May 15th with another episode. If you have any thoughts on this episode, please post a comment below. We love responding. We love reading them and responding to them. And once again, don't forget to check out the Silver Chair Reading Group. Go to narniweb.com, click forum, go over to the Silver Chair Reading Group, and just respond to a couple questions. If you want to contact one of us individually, you can email us at glumpuddle@narniweb.com or twigs@narniweb.com. Until next time, further up and further in.
Further up and further in.